You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Morning, Tri-State. I am so excited to be back this Saturday, finally with some sunshine. It's a great day to be clean and sober, but more than anything, the guests that I have today, you know what, when you hear their stories, if you don't get some hope and if you don't get some direction about where you can go, if you have any family members or yourself suffering from a drinking problem or drug problem, then you haven't listened to the show. These guys have been around in the rooms of sobriety and recovery in this community and abroad for over 30 years, but they still talk from the heart to the newcomer about how to get clean and sober, how they've stayed clean and sober. Both of them helped me get into the greatest fellowship on earth. So I am proud to have both of them here. They're going to give each other a hard time. I hope they don't give me a hard time. But both of them, they just have incredible stories of hope. So I don't want to take up more time. Welcome. Don't hesitate to call 424-1400 if you have any questions. Nothing's below the belt. I'm going to start off introducing you to Joe, who very affectionately we used to call Little Joe because he is short but mighty and strong, coaches around the tri-state, is retired from the Air Force, and continues still to carry the message. And following him will be Chuck, who's been an incredible contributor too. He's retired now, so he's out having good times going to New Orleans and taking sobriety with him everywhere. So let me introduce you to Joe. Hi, Joe. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me on the air. And this is kind of unusual for me. It might be one of the first times my whole life I've been at a loss for words.
No.
But
Chuck,
I don't,
do we believe that?
No, it won't last long. So,
but I don't know what Lisa was saying when she said, Joe, you got the great face for radio. I don't know what she's trying to talk bad about me or what. But anyway, I'm glad to be here and with the audience out here. And whatever I say is my opinion or what I've experienced or what I've observed. And we haven't planned anything or anything like that. She said, tell a little bit about your story. And I'll do that. And anytime you want to call in, you know, call in. Don't feel free to interrupt. I think that's the purpose of the show. This thing's grown from what I understand from a half hour to an hour. So somebody out there is listening. I don't know who you are, but I don't know if Lisa paid her family to listen or what and call in or how that works. But I am really glad to be here. And Chuck, I've known for a long time, and I always kid Chuck about I knew him when he wouldn't hardly pronounce a word. Now I'm going to speak on the mic here, and this is my friend Chuck. When we got started, that's how Chuck sounded. All right, so
he was drugged up.
Hey, we're just so happy to be there. This part I can't speak for Chuck. Normally, I don't speak for anybody but me. But you know, Chuck is happy to be here, and Chuck and I have known each other for a long time and done some travels in recovery and met some nice people and went through some things when he had a family member pass on, was able to be there, and you know, things like that. You know, the things that normal people do that don't have to worry about going out and, you know, getting a buzz, getting a drink, you know, just to function in life. Mm-hmm. And I always have to remember it because I wasn't the one that that got along out there. You know, my best efforts, my best thinking got me in trouble. So I'll just tell you a little bit about me. I try and keep it brief because I know Chuck has something to say. Some of my other friends might not leave any room, you know what I mean? But
we'll see. It's early.
That's right. It's early. And my lips are moving. I may be lying is what I've been told. So, but
I don't think so.
But I'm originally from Evansville, I came back to Evansville about 10 years ago. I've had a nice military career, but my family has always been around alcohol, that German tradition. I don't know if you say unfortunate or whatever, but between the German, the Irish, and the Native American, I didn't have a prayer, I guess.
Just biologically, you were set up. Huh?
But our family reunion, stuff like that. That German tradition is always beer around. And my first really drink that I really remember, besides little sips, was when I was about 9 years old with my grandfather. So he made some homemade wine, and the result of that was I blacked out. I came to. I threw up, and then it's like 9 years old. Mm. And And that was my first experience. For a long time, I couldn't even smell watermelon candy because he made that homemade peach wine, and we had watermelon at the kitchen table. I remember hanging that head on the table, and that's all I remember.
So it wasn't a pleasurable experience at first.
I don't know. I can't say. Speak to
remember.
It. So apparently it went well for a while. So, but I blacked out early. You know, some people work at it. And I've had friends, different places, say they never blacked out. They had skips. And you call it whatever you want. You know, they had some people lost days. Some people lose hours. Some people lose minutes. And, you know, some people, from what I hear, might lose decades. I don't know. I take them at their word. But that's my really first experience. I drank time. I was regular from the time I was 12 till I hit recovery. So regular is every opportunity I got. And when you're 12, there's less opportunities. But if you carry newspapers, you know, who has it on their porches? Mm-hmm. And things like that. So I knew where to go, where to run, and I knew how to get in certain places. And today they're a little smarter with doors. It's a little harder to take the hinges off to get to the booze. So, but that's kind of how I did it. And like I said, I had no reason to drink per se. My dad had talked to somebody in recovery about what to do about Joe when I was 16. So that tells you that I was probably in trouble before that. You know, your parents are, I won't say the last to know, but last to admit, I think, from my experience. And Lisa could tell you that. She's a professional counselor. I'm just an amateur.
No, I think is true. The denial of parents.
That plausible denial. Yeah. I don't want to believe. You give me an excuse not to believe.
And when he noticed it at 16, yeah, you're right. You were in trouble.
So I was in trouble. But they used to kid me all the time. My story's nothing special. I used to tell about, you know, about drinking, you know, losing my mind, losing my memory, losing my clothes and coming to type thing. Mm. And we kid about I was streaking in the 70s before streaking became a fad.
You brought it in.
So policemen don't like it when you throw underwear in their car.
You were wild, Joe.
So we had a pretty good time. And, you know, and my definition of a pretty good time has changed. But also, what was my solution? Quit working. I feel like I quite fit in till I was about 12, and that's when I really, you know, started drinking. And then everything seemed to work. It worked for me. It was my solution. And later on in life, it quit working for me. It was no longer my solution. It was my problem. And that's hard to face. Something that's worked for you so well for so long, and then all of a sudden it's no longer working. In fact, working against you is kind of hard to take. And friends around me and from some other friends, it's even harder for them to say, hey, there's something wrong with them when they're obsessed about your drinking, trying to control what you do. And the big joke was a friend of mine used to talk about he did the drinking and his spouse got the brain damage. Mm-hmm. And because she was so obsessed on trying to control him, keep him out of trouble, keep him from getting hurt, it really affected her. And as many people who are familiar with in recovery and treatment, you know, alcoholism is a family disease, a family illness. And, you know, that's the big thing about it. You know, we don't even realize. And but
do you think you realized you were affecting your parents?
No, I didn't think so. Now, I knew later on, but, you know, when you're bringing people in at 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, at home, and people got to go to work and go to school, they frown on that. I thought it was pretty quiet, but apparently I wasn't as quiet as I thought I was. But, you know,
so
it's
all through high school, Joe, you drank heavily?
Pretty much so. During certain sports seasons, I didn't because I didn't like to lose. But other than that, I found for me, I had all these feelings for every drink, and then the drinking kind of took them away, and I had no reason not to feel any different than anybody. I didn't, because my folks had very few rules per se. You know, you're going to be at home at supper time, and you're going to say please, thank you, yes sir, no sir, yes ma'am, no ma'am. You know, things that people do all the time for good manners and getting along with their fellow human beings. So I had all that, but I just never felt like I quite fit in, and then bang, there it went. And I used to be able to tell you a lot of times when I went to college. I always, from my eighth grade on, it's my tell you something. I wanted to go to IU because, you know, the Rolling Stone article, Party University, and that was one of my goals. I used to tell people I had three goals, and I can only remember two of them. One was to go to IU, and the other one was to be in a Turkish hash den and fall out after 3 days. So most people probably don't think about that when they're in eighth grade, but you know, that's my goal.
When you're drug affected, I guess you do think of that.
But I say I had no reason to drink to excess, to have these feelings of inadequacy, but I did, and I don't know why. I mean, you know, it's funny when I came sober up. I didn't really, didn't much bother me. But when I was 9 or 10 years old, I got second grade, I was 8. And I wanted to be a priest. And then, you know, when you've seen me early when I come up, that's the last person you ever think I'm going to be a priest.
No, for sure.
You know, Lord help them.
Not enough freedom for you.
There we go.
Priest.
But, and then they go completely the opposite. But I found, you know, that whatever was missing in the bottle, and I used to use some other substances to enhance it, but the alcohol was my drug of choice. And it easy to get. In the old days, the old paper licenses, the old typewriter.
Oh, there wasn't even drug driving laws yet.
So, no, in fact, you know, by today's standard, I'd probably been a felon. You know, they would stop you. And if you were stupid enough to say you can't make it home, you can't drive, then they might arrest you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they tell you, oh, I'm fine. And they usually, every now and then, the police would say, don't move. So, you know, stay there. Or they take your beer and drunk. You know, if there's a full case, they would take it. I don't know what happened to it. I don't know if it ever made it to an evidence room or not. I don't want to cast any aspersions, but other times they pour it out in front of you. But it was different there in the 70s. You know, things that we took for granted and kind of goof off.
Where'd you go to high school?
I'd rather not say.
Oh. I mean, do you think it matters, though, really?
No, I don't, because it was funny. Some of the high schools say this one, you can get your stuff now. I know when I went to high school, if you was going to party and stuff, you went to another high school.
It's not really the school.
It's not really the school. No, it's just a matter of who has access, who has older brothers and sisters that's going to get that stuff for you.
Yeah.
But, but it's just one of those things that you never, you know, whoever goes up saying, I'm going to plan on being, you know, a drunk or a drug addict or, you know, get in trouble, embarrass people. And I don't know how many people plan to do that, you know. And, you know, in fact, I was kind of a little whacked. I was going to go out and get a job, make a lot of money, and impress people I didn't like. So, you know, I was a little twisted. But drinking with Lincoln. You know, those $5 drink and drown. I don't know how much drinking, but I sure as heck drowned. But I ended up coming back because I knew what was happening up there. It was getting bad. I wasn't going to class. And when I knocked out my best friend in college, a kid from New Jersey over a flag football game, I said, that's enough. You know, I tell people I majored in beer and pinball at college initially. But, you know, later on, I finally did complete college. My friends up here said, don't go. You'll never come back. And they were right here to make it back to IU, but I do have a degree from SIU Carbondale and through the community college of the Air Force. So this, I just went a roundabout path. You know, I crammed 4 years of education in 8 years, I think.
His senior year was the best 3 years of his life.
There you go. But it's just amazing the things that have happened. And here's the things that I have learned. For me, I skipped a lot of things. I think it's unnecessary, but I'll tell you this. I was a captain of my sports team. I was a National Honor Society student. I had college scholarships for sports and for academics. And I had no reason to feel inadequate or to drink to excess. I had no reason to. But, you know, that's what made me feel normal. So I'm not saying how good I think I am or thought I was or anything like that.
Alcoholism took its course.
So
even with
equal opportunity thing, I think. And, you know, some of my friends drank like I did and didn't have any much problem. Or I might even notice what they did. I'm more concerned about what I was doing. But
so how'd you finally, what made you finally decide to quit?
I always had a sense for a while I was in trouble. And when I come back from IU, I thought, I know, Chuck, you can probably vouch for this. I'll change location instead of be different.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, Chuck even went to treatment somewhere else.
Yeah.
Different location.
Yeah, New Orleans.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Chuck's the high bottom. I kid Chuck about being a high bottom drunk. He went to New Orleans.
I
was in the basement of an old folks home for my treatment center.
Regina, that's right.
I thought mopping up the water when it rained was part of the program.
Oh, that's hilarious.
No, but see, I went to New Orleans because I was unique, because at that time I was an alcoholic, but I was also a drug addict. And at that time in Evansville, they only dealt with pure alcoholics. They would not touch a drug addict. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go, the lady talked me into going to New Orleans. And then I got tricked because I wound up on the alcohol recovery ward instead of a drug treatment ward. And I was kind of upset with that, but that's another story.
I was telling Joe, before the radio show that you couldn't get treated here in town because you were in the drug, oh, God forbid, the drug addicts.
Well, I was unique, see. That was part of my problem, too.
Yeah.
I had that terminal uniqueness that almost killed me, too.
Ooh, yeah. I've seen that take a lot of people in recovery down.
Yeah, yeah.
So Joe was in the basement. He was low bottom. Were you the youngest at the time, too?
Yeah, at that time I was. People come in. When I hit the rooms of recovery, it was. I tell people I was 19. If I want to be a... What words are you allowed to say on air? But anyway...
Anything you want.
But I don't know how the FCC monitors things. I thought I'd do good, keep you off trouble. And I will tell a story on Lisa. But
no, you don't have to do that.
I'm not real bad, but let's put it this way. They would monitor my talk sometime, and I'd give the X-rated talk. And Lisa made me look like a choir boy, and I need to say more.
Oh, no.
We talk about progress versus... perfection, but yeah, she can make me blush swearing. You know, I had to give it up. And, you know, I was military and could swear, and she make me blush.
And look at her now.
That's
know,
right.
Got her own radio show.
our girl.
You who would have thought?
Oh, really?
I wouldn't have. That's for sure. This is the miracle of the program, isn't it?
You know, and we laugh and we cut up and we talk. You know, with each other about each other. We share with things. We have fun like this, and that's part of. I can really speak for all three of us on this. It's part of our recovery. Because it's what we do, and that's how we share. It's funny, you tell somebody, well, I got in a car, I hit a telephone pole, almost killed myself, and people, ha, 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 how funny.
Because, offer you their phone number.
That's right. You know, right. They'll laugh, and we kid around sometimes about, you know, people in recovery meetings, you know, where can you go and have so much fun for, you know a couple of bucks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because we've been there, and we had the same feelings, and what I wanted to express was I always felt different, and when I come to a meeting and heard somebody tell their stories, I heard how they felt. Mm-hmm. And because I don't think I'd have made it, because I was so different. And like I was saying, if I want to really, you know, write people, talk about when I had my last drink, I was 18 years old, 364 days is how old I was, because I was afraid of going to detox.
At 19, almost.
So I was, because we did the talk. They said, just don't drink for 3 days before you get here. Mm-hmm. And I understood that part. And I knew enough about alcoholism to be dangerous. I mean, I didn't want to go into detox, afraid somebody mistake me for a spider or something like that, or a bug, and grab me.
Because, you know, DTs back then, that's right, and hallucinations. So, used to see people in serious hallucinations.
So, I mean, I knew about that, enough to be dangerous. Not most alcoholics don't get that. I say the ones in recovery don't get that far, but, you know, there's still that's still out there. And
remember at Stepping Stone, we'd have to, when JJ was there, Chuck, you got, I don't know if you weren't doing
it. I was banned.
They were still going into DTs then, and Dinah Kramer would be over your face telling you, wake up, you're just hallucinating. You don't see that anymore.
No, there was a guy at St. Mary's before I got there, they talked about they had to cover up, the TV was off, they had to cover it off. Because the guy seeing the TV, seeing reflection, was seeing you know, whatever he was seeing, but they had to cover it up to settle him down.
And now that's usually methamphetamine. You're hallucinating, not the alcoholism so much.
Yeah, a new drug of the choice of the decade now. Mm-hmm. But it's funny because a lot of the same reasons why Joe drank was the same reasons I drank, you know, because, you know, I just didn't fit in. And then all of a sudden there was this liquid that, you know, it gave me courage and I could speak and, you know, I could walk up to women and, you know, ask them to dance and, you know, all the stuff that a normal person does without anything. You know, I wasn't capable of doing it without some sort of mood-altering substance.
Did you know that it was troublesome to you, too? Did you know you did it excessively?
Well, by the end, yeah, because I had tried. I knew my life wasn't... what I thought it should be, but I didn't think that it was because of the drugs and the alcohol. I just thought I was on a bad roll, which I was on a bad roll, but it was self-induced. So, I tried different things, and I went back to the church where I was raised, and nothing happened. I thought by just walking in the door something would happen. Nothing happened, And I just stumbled around for a long time, and then my significant other at the time asked me if I would meet this lady from who was out of town, and I said, sure. And she wanted me to go to treatment, but she wanted me to go to treatment in Minnesota for
Hazleton.
90 days.
Hazleton.
I didn't know it was, but that was Hazleton, you know, and that just scared me to death. But I couldn't tell her that I was scared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hem-hauled around for about another week, and then out of just sheer desperation, because I knew that the end was near, because by this time I was always a loner, but I had some associates, and by now associates were dying, getting prison terms,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I knew the end of the road was coming. And
you mean death or prison?
Both.
Either one was going to happen
to
you. Yeah,
to me, they were one and the same. For me to go to, because, you know, I made it through my active drinking without getting arrested. And because my father, he was pretty strict. You know, he told me, you know, if I ever got arrested, don't bother. You only get that one phone call. I said, don't bother wasting it on calling me because there's nothing I can do. And so I knew that I couldn't con him into getting me out of jail. So I was always afraid of going to jail, but I was doing things that were going to send me to jail. You know, it was one of those oxymoron kind of a deal. But eventually, I knew that life wasn't, my quality of life was bad. And there was no reason for it. And I started to search to try and figure out just what the deal is. And finally, as a last resort, I had to look at my drinking and my drugging. And and then eventually I had to look at me. You know, I couldn't be the victim anymore. I had to take an active role in my life, you know, and I didn't like that at all. You know?
That goes against young people's mindset.
Right. You know, it's a lot easier being a victim than an actual
victor.
That I brought this on myself. But
so do you guys think you have to come to terms with that eventually, whether you're young or old? You have to really accept, I did this and I have to treat it.
Oh, my view, yeah, you know.
Me too, but on a different level, I have to take responsibility, but I can't treat myself.
Right.
Because you're about the same age as me, Chuck. You know, remember, it's like you can do anything you want to if you put your mind to it. The impossible just take a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people in treatment, one of the first things they tell you is you got to surrender to win. And like, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
You know, what do you mean surrender?
What does that mean?
Yeah, and do things like totally different than you've done your whole life.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. When you first come here, they're talking a foreign language. You know, like, what do you mean? You know.
Mm-hmm. So do you think treatment? Because you said you can't do it alone. Was that the beginning of your?
That's what I needed. Now, people that sobered up the same time as I did, they didn't go to treatment. But see, the thing about it, when Little Joe was around for a while, then he went in the military, but there were a group of us, 318 Madison,
mm-hmm.
was where the really
young
began.
Young people's meeting, yeah.
It was a young people's meeting, and at that time, I was a young person. You know?
Yeah. Pat Rhodes' sponsor helped you start that, though, Jim Thomas,
yeah.
Remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the old did help the young.
Oh, yeah.
It was a young people's group.
And, you know, and we were wild and crazy and fun and cut up. But whenever someone had a true problem with drinking, all the fun stopped and we, you know, switched into the strictly recovery mode, and with the advice and sharing our experience, strength, and hope. And we grew up together. There's still several of us from that meeting who are sober, and we see each other on a regular basis. And occasionally we get together and have lunch or breakfast or something and talk about the old days and
reminisce.
Yeah, it's come a long way.
Yes.
Yeah, the more things change, the more they remain the same, don't they? They just, the hairs just kind of faded away or changed colors. And, yeah, it used to be little Joe. Now it's more like old Joe.
Joe, you helped start St. Ben's, didn't you, with Father Warren? You guys really helped kick that one off. That was so important for me early on.
There were several of us that did that, and a friend of mine would kind of laugh about Warren and said, well, one of these days he's going to be with us.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And he is.
Yeah.
But anybody that's out there, if you don't understand what we're saying, that's okay. And those of you do, you know, if you're thinking about stopping, you know, call AA, talk to your minister, whatever, too. A lot of ministers today don't try and just do it through the church. A lot of them also do church and try and get you in some type of recovery program. And a friend of mine who's no longer with the deceased, he said he went to AA to save his life. He went to church to save his soul. He didn't have any problem doing both. But I found for me that I couldn't do it on my own. I couldn't do it through church. I had to do it through a recovery program. And for me, it happened to work best was AA. And I know it's not the only way. Some people have gotten started in AA and gone back to their church and got real active and do both. And some end up going back to church. But I think what I've experienced, what I've observed, AA works best for most. But AA does not have a franchise on it by any means.
No, there's several ways to. The bottom line is recovery. Mm-hmm. No matter how you get there, whether it's church or youth group or working for the women's shelter or men's shelter or something, the main thing is just having this relationship with a power greater than yourself. That's where it all boils down to.
Well, that is a good way to stop the first half of our show. Maybe when we come back, Radio Rehab audience, we'll talk more about recovery and how to get there and how these guys work their recovery program. Don't go away, Tri-State. We'll be back right after a break.
African Americans Yesterday and Today, sponsored by Zeta Zeta Omega Chapter of the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated.
And now, a moment in Black history.
Fannie L. Jackson Coppin was born in Washington, D.C. in 1835 and left an orphan at an early age. Her aunt bought her freedom for $125. Fannie worked for her schooling and went to Oberlin College in Ohio, where she graduated in 1865. She accepted a teacher position in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the Institute for Colored Youth. In 1874, became principal and was outstanding as an educator until her death, January 21, 1913. Mrs. Coppin was active as organizer and lecturer in the Black women's rights movements.
Listening to the radio. It's me again. Have you got that HIV test yet? As I mentioned before, if you have put yourself at risk by having unprotected sex with more than one person or used IV drugs, guess what? You've put yourself at risk for HIV. Make that appointment today by calling the Vandenberg County Health Department at 435-5683 or stop by 420 East Mulberry. It's that easy. Remember, everything is confidential. No one has to know you've gotten the test unless you tell them, so do it. What do you have to lose except maybe your life or your partner's life? When in doubt, get checked out.
You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call. at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-8467. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Welcome back, Tri-State. We're back with two of my favorite men in the whole world from Alcoholics Anonymous and just from the rooms and doors of recovery, always reaching out. Well, hopefully you've been listening to the first half hour because they were sharing a lot about their experience in the depths of their addiction. So we thought we'd spend the rest of the time now talking about recovery, because I know a lot of calls we get here are, how do you get in recovery? What's recovery look like? Is anybody too young? Da, 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 da. So we've got these experts here that can answer to some of those questions from their experience. And if you have any, don't hesitate to call 424-1400. We're here and we'll do the best we can to answer your questions. What's recovery look like and how do you get it?
Well, for me, you know, it started with treatment, but then the treatment facility I went to was real AA orientated, so and they told me once I get out to get a temporary sponsor. And for those who may or may not know what a sponsor is, it's almost like a guide through the 12 steps. And that's where recovery starts, you know, in my opinion. And it just one thing led to another. And I eventually found a sponsor and worked with him, and he guided me through the steps, and I was able to look at myself and look at what part I had played in a lot of the problems that I had created. That's the way.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think for me, a similar approach, other than the fact that the definition of an expert, X is a has-been, and a spurt is only a drip under pressure. So that tells you what kind of expert I am. But I think the treatment helped me because it kept me under a protected environment for a little bit, and I'm kind of impulsive.
And, Is that a trait you think of most alcoholics and addicts?
This one. But also for me, they convinced me to take Anabuse, and that was the reason I took it. I thought, well, I'd get mad or do something, I would do something stupid. So I knew on Anabuse you couldn't drink.
Yeah, and, I tried that too.
Yeah, we won't talk about your Anabuse story right now. But we'll save that for another time. And she'll never invite me back.
Yes,
but,
so sure.
We'll share that story.
So you knew you needed extra help. So
yeah, but
abuse.
But I really wasn't convinced I was an alcoholic.
Oh, okay.
See, that's a good thing about AA and the treatment center. You don't have to be an alcoholic to go.
You don't have to say you're an alcoholic?
No. I was merely a problem drinker, Chuck. Imagine that.
Yeah.
So you can call yourself whatever you want to call yourself.
Yeah, you don't have to. You can use someone else's name if you want. I mean, it's really up to you.
Yeah.
Because I found in the fellowship, you can be as anonymous as you want to be, and if you want to talk to somebody and be a friend, most of the time, not all the time, but you just stick your hand out and say, "Hey, I'm so and so," and people are glad to talk to you. And sometimes they don't even talk; they just listen. And you know, sometimes that was a big thing for me, having somebody listen to. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I'd be, you know, in 2 years I'd be 21. I'd be legal. I'd be able to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But something happened in the meantime. And it was funny. Not everybody gets this thing the first time. I suggest anybody go out there and do your own research, as we talk about in the rooms. But a guy that took him 6 years to stick was the one that convinced me to go to meetings. Because you know, he said the only thing he did right was he kept coming back. And that's the guy who convinced me. And that was the guy I helped move when I left the treatment center. And when I went to Missouri and then came back and stopped in St. Louis, was ready to go drink, that little coin was in there, one of those little gimmicks they give you in the meetings. And instead of putting, you know, go buying, even though I was illegal, I don't know how I was going to buy it, I was still going to get that alcohol some way.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to buy some booze, I put like $2.75, something like that, in change in the phone booth, calling back to the treatment center because the only number I had, I didn't have anybody else's number. And what was funny, when I left, this guy gave me literally two handfuls of change. He knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me to my first out-of-town meeting. And like I say, you know, I'm old now, but the couple that were there in that place, mm-hmm. they were old to me still. I mean, a couple old gray hairs, blue hairs. You know, I got gray. They were blue.
Wow.
But it was smoke
filled
meeting.
So age wasn't a factor and isn't really.
No, it's not. I had so many reasons to be different, you know, and Chuck too, to be different because we were younger. Mm-hmm. You know, people drank longer than I'd been alive.
Yeah.
They tell me, well, I'm glad you haven't suffered as much as I have.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah.
So you guys both had to put up with that?
You know, how much more could I take?
They meant, well, yeah.
I mean, I figured if I made past 25, I was doing good, because I figured by 25, I was going to be, I don't think I'd been suicidal, be more like homicidal, I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, you know, my ego was that big, I think.
So you guys, though, also had families that weren't going to enable you. Do you think that's key, too? Because, Chuck, you said your dad told you, don't call me if you end up in jail.
Right. And, you know, but the thing about it, mom being a mom, she's mm-hmm. going to take care of her baby boy.
Smotherly
and,
love.
Yeah, and almost sure. loved me to death, you know, until finally, you know, I got sick and tired of the feeling of using them and using my significant other because I, you know, we know right from wrong. We don't want to admit it sometimes, mm-hmm. but, you know, there was a sense still in me that this is wrong and you need to do something about it. And it wasn't until I first came here that I found a way to do something about it.
Yeah, I used to tell people I got here on my own. then the light came on.
Yeah.
But because when I went through treatment, they messed up. I told you earlier that I don't drink for 3 days. I understood that. I didn't. They made concessions to get me in. And you come in on a Sunday, didn't count as your weekend in because I didn't want to be locked in. All this crazy stuff. You know, me.
Yeah, they didn't have day treatment back then.
No,
night treatment. No. You were in. Overnight.
And they said, well, call on Sunday. We'll have a bed ready for you. I call on Sunday. And which was unusual. I actually listened to somebody. My mom said, why don't you call? I said, no, that'd be all right. They said they'd have a bed for me. And I called, you know, I actually listened to somebody for once, which is highly unusual. And I called, and there was no room at the inn. I was an unhappy camper, to say the least. Those of you who've been in recovery talk about the, you know, that can't live without alcohol, can't imagine living with it. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a week later, I got a bed, and so now I've been dry like 10 days. They call, hey, we got a bed for you. And I'm thinking, well, thank you very much. I don't think I'm that bad yet. And my dad, he didn't tell me I had to go. But if I didn't go, I wouldn't stay in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as dumb as I look. Some things are physically impossible. But so I went to treatment, and you know, with a boot up my behind.
Mm-hmm.
I had a choice. I mean, I could go to treatment. I didn't have to, but I wouldn't stay in there.
Mm-hmm.
And
so your families were pretty serious about you guys getting better, for sure.
I think so. They're tired, you know, you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, mm-hmm. and they're sick and tired of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's
crazy.
True.
So that's how it kind of worked for me on that part of it. But
so did your families get involved in your recovery with you too?
Not for me.
No. It was funny because they at one time. I had been in for some time, and my mom got sick, and by this time, Dad had retired and moved to Kentucky, but she was in the hospital here in Evansville, and so she was in the ICU ward, and so we could only see her for half an hour, 15 minutes or something. So while we were waiting to see her again, I got my dad and took him over to a meeting, and it was, the first time he'd ever been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And there was a speaker, and then after the speaker, they went around a table with discussions. And you know, Dad was impressed because they were talking about God.
Yeah.
And see, God, Dad was a church going person. He says, anything that talks about God is got to be okay, and you've done so well with my son now that, you know, it's got to be okay. Because he was pretty skeptical. He thought it was some kind of cult, and, mm-hmm. you know, and what had I gotten myself into.
Yeah.
But after he went that first time, then he kind of...
The God flavor helped.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that, well, Joe, you had mentioned too, church is important, but that AA does some different things. You think it is the 12 steps that makes it different than... the church?
I would think it's not a whole lot of thou shalt not.
That's true.
I think it is what it is, and they're similar. And you know, some people will tell you that stuff was taken from the big book, and I don't really know. I don't really care. I just know it works. Mm-hmm. I think I reached a point where it didn't matter. You know, that I had to do something different, because I went to AA, didn't want to go. I looked at it kind of like church, because it was kind of like ritual, because they did this, did that. And I went on to speak for my first 90 days.
Well, I asked a minister on here once why he didn't send more people to the fellowship, and he was pretty candid and said they don't talk about the gospel there. He couldn't in good faith send people that where there wasn't discussion of the gospel. I said, have you ever been to a meeting? He said, no. I said, well, there's a lot of talk about a higher power there. And isn't that what the gospel is?
Well, the thing with me, I go to, you know, it took me a long time to go to organized religion, because I had, I wasn't mad at God, but I didn't know how to connect with God, because prior to, there were a lot of born again people, and they were kind of scary to me. Just coming in and working on my recovery, I was able to have a power greater than myself that I could rely on, and it was my power. It wasn't your conception of the power. It was, it wasn't my, when I was a kid, God, you know, it was, I formed my own relationship with him, and that in itself made it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking earlier, I think for the one thing that I like about Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not a lot of preaching. It's more a sharing experience, you know. Mm-hmm. And today, I've got guys that I sponsor, and I don't tell them what to do. I tell them what I've done and how it worked out for me. You're free to do whatever you think you want to do. Mm-hmm. And
there's no thou shalt.
Right.
Or thou shalt not.
It's more sharing, and, you know, this is what worked for me.
Well, how come you weren't more empathetic with me when I came in?
Because you were hardcore. You know, couldn't tell you anything.
That's right. She knew it all already.
Yeah.
She was having so much fun.
Yeah, with them two black eyes.
Yeah. She was a sweetheart.
Yeah.
So, recovery. Does that mean 100% from everything? Or is it, if your alcohol was your thing, you can still come in, but you can use other drugs? Or if meth or crack cocaine was your thing, it's still okay to smoke some pot and drink? In your hearts, I know there's no rules, but would recovery mean 100% abstinence from everything?
At one time, I thought you might be able to play a little bit, but I've found from what other people have experienced that if you don't need it, it's not necessary. Why use it? You know, why take that risk? I know for me, drinking is to die. And who, if I get experimenting, what happens? I lose judgment, even though I didn't get in trouble with the other stuff, and then make that fatal decision, and then here I go, I'm off and running again. I know I got another drunk in me. I don't have another sobering up in me. And I've seen some folks, literally, you know, young guys, a number of years ago, you know, die in the gutter. And this is a young guy.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you traveled, you were in the service too, and you see some of these big towns, people literally walk over you in the gutter.
Yeah. You know, and for me, I can't take mood altering substance, period. And I'm not a big taker now of anything. About the strongest thing I take is ibuprofen. And I could have cut my arm off, and all I want is ibuprofen. Mm-hmm. I just know how addictive personality that I've got, and something that's going to make me feel better and good. I want more of it, you know. And so I get up now because I'm 60 years old, and aches and pains, and that's part of being 60 years old. You know, I'm not, you know, 30 anymore.
Run into the pharmacy, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, I think everybody finds their own path, but most people who are, knodgeable would definitely, you know, that's served me well. I said with Chuck, you know, I try and stay from mood-altering drugs. When I had a little surgery, Afterwards, I was fortunate enough I didn't need anything but aspirin. So I try and avoid. And when I see the doctor or when I go see the dentist, I say, you know, they write down ETOH, something like, you know, ethyl alcohol, yes, allergic, something like that. And I say, I'm going to try to avoid mood-altering drugs.
Yes.
And then they write that on my chart. And and I haven't had any trouble with when I've had fillings or anything like that. But I think it's like anything else. You got to be honest with your health care provider, with anybody.
And protective with yourself.
Right.
Because they can write it innocently thinking.
You ought to join the military and have it put in your records where you rejoin, you know, but it never come back to haunt me. So,
are you too open about being recovering to people?
I'm a little selective per se. I'm not preaching from the
right,
the hilltops, but if somebody that I think might benefit or someone might ask a question, I'll tell them then. I've been on a job site, and I was up at French Lick working. There's a guy from somewhere in Illinois that he'd been in recovery, and there's some guy, young guy we're trying to help that, you know, T-boned somebody, you know, drunk and ran. You know, that's not good decision-making in my book. But you just tell them, say, hey, this is what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like the thing. And when I was in the service, my roommate would tell my story for me.
Knew so well.
He knew, but not because he wanted that I was anything great. There was another kid in there that was having problems. And he wanted that kid to have help, so he brought the guy over to my room.
Sure.
So you know, I think that's how I kind of do it. It's
yeah.
I don't believe
word of mouth referrals.
So I don't believe going out there. That's, you know, like right, we're here. We don't give any last names or anything like that. I don't think that works. It takes the me out of it. You know the big ego.
Yeah.
And it's an attraction thing. And I think it's right opportunities because my family didn't go with me on my recovery journey per se. But when I had a great uncle, that someone said, hey, would you talk to him? I said, mm-hmm. I said, if he asks, I'll talk to him. Because that's something I'm new. But my dad asked me, why you still go to the meetings? I said, you like me the way I was? Well, no. Okay. And that's all. And that was fine for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all he needed to know. He went to a meeting with me before. And I think it's easier to have family with me. But I think in my circumstance, it was good because I was on my, you know, with just me. I could go to meetings if I wanted to. I don't have to worry about a significant other. I mean, in those days, who the heck would have me at the end? You know what I mean? I'd be a sick cookie. So, but it's just one of those things. I think it's a personal thing. Some people,
yeah.
I've heard of people who been in the rooms, have fallen off the water wagon, for better lack of terms, being a bar, telling people that they got to go to meetings.
Yeah.
You need to go.
They're
drinking, yeah.
But, you know, what's funny is they get people in the rooms.
Yeah.
And then some of them stay, some of them don't. It's like, you know, with your court program. Some of them folks stay, you know, some of them don't. But it's, I think if you save one person, I don't from all the other misery and going through the jail, was it 70% of people in the prisons is drug and alcohol related? Just think of what we could do then. How much money would we be saving? You know, I guess America locks up more of its population than anybody. You know, look how much money we could save. Look how many lives you could put together if you could do it. I don't know how you do it because the recovery rate is low. But I think between a little bit of counseling and encouraging people to go to, whether it's NA, you know, CA, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, whatever, to find that recovery tool.
And there is Cocaine Anonymous here now, like 3 or 4 meetings a week. And Narcotics Anonymous has their own clubhouses.
So, I mean, it's slow to go.
So it's, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because I just came off of a cruise. And, you know, they said, you know, only thing you can do is eat and drink on a cruise. And I did my share of eating. And but it's, you know, it's been a long time since I've had a drink. So there wasn't any, for me, it wasn't any real threat. But I met some people on the cruise who didn't drink. And there was a big party going on. And this guy, he had a beer can in his hand. And he was telling me, I don't drink. It's just to keep his friends from offering him a drink. And so we sat and talked and carried on and had a good time. And he goes, I'll feel good in the morning. They won't, you know. And I go, oh,
yeah.
my feelings exactly, you know. And
they have meetings on cruises,
yeah,
too. Friends of Bill W.,
yeah,
they call it.
Yeah, yeah. Every day there was a meeting.
Was there every day?
Yeah. And, it, you know, the recovery is available. You know, even they have the loners and international, the people that are on remote islands, you know, they can stay in contact mm-hmm. with the book and writing one another. So
and the internet now?
Yeah, oh, the internet, yeah.
Goodness.
I met a guy in Germany that was living in France that was down from Paducah, Kentucky, that knew some of the same people I knew. It's a small world.
And he
went to the meetings there in the south of France, and he didn't speak any French, and there was hardly anybody passed by. He always talked about the one drunk Frenchman that was always there. Every now and then somebody passed through, but every week he'd be there.
What do you guys recommend to people that say, gosh, you know, I've had somebody I've loved and sent there and been in treatment and gone to the meetings? What do you think for you really had to happen that makes it easier to get it, whatever it is for each person?
I don't know. For me, I think it's just sticking around long enough for the miracle to happen. Mm-hmm. And there's no set time limit. Just one day or one night, all of a sudden, the light bulb will go off that, hey, you know, I too can be a productive member of society, and I don't have to rely upon alcohol or drugs.
Mm-hmm. If you're going out there in front of the judge, in front of your parents, you're tired of apologizing, and people ask you, why do you do this stupid stuff? And you don't know why. If they would tell you, you would know also. Maybe you want to get in these rooms and see what happens, because it's free. It don't cost anything but your time, and you'd be amazed. I remember a friend of mine used to offer me to go out to drinks afterwards, and I used to laugh at her and say, if your husband sits me up with some of his clients who I won't go into what he was an attorney, and and I'm a male, and you can understand where I'm coming from on that. You read between the lines. But he represents some ladies that used to dance. I said, set me up with some of those. I might want to go with you. Oh. Now, just, you know, if you're going to lie, lie big. And she happened to come to the room and goes, what's he doing here? And the same thing she was doing. She was new. Because if you think about it, I heard a guy one time talk, said, if you close your eyes and describe an alcoholic, what would it be? It'd be a he, mm-hmm. old, brown bag, in the street. And it's not. It's the guy in the suit. It's the woman at home with the you know, kids in the picket fence.
It's the high school kid.
It's the teenager. It's that that all American boy or all American girl, that honor student, and it's all the above. Mm-hmm. And you can't if you see their behavior, you can pick it out. But other than that, don't look any different than anybody else.
Right. And that's the thing about it. This is a equal opportunity mm-hmm. destroyer. This disease doesn't care how much money you got or where you live or what kind of car you drive or walk. If you have the disease and it's left untreated, it'll kill you.
Mm-hmm. And take a lot of people down with you.
No matter how successful you're on the outside. You know, some people have enough money that they may not ever lose anything physically.
Mm-hmm. More functional, yeah.
But the other stuff goes on and the turmoil and stuff like that. And they may lose a few. They might die a little bit before their time. You just never know. But that personal insanity, because I know for me it wasn't so much a physical thing. It was a mental thing. Because you know, the way I look at it, you reach your bottom is between your ears when it's enough for you.
Right.
Because, I mean, what I did wasn't much for some folks, and for others it'd be too much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extremely
personal.
Yeah, that's
the other thing you hear from a lot of people. They have to want it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, the fellowship's for people who want it, not for people who need it. If it was for people that need it, there's not a place in town big enough to hold for everybody to go to.
The jails are full of
people. You know, the new arena would be too small.
Yeah.
And that's what my first temporary sponsor told me. He says, you know, meetings are habits. You can get into the habit of going or you can get into the habit of not going. And I luckily got into the habit of going. I was scared to death. That's why I went on a regular basis, and I didn't want to meet anybody. I didn't want to do any of the things that I had to do, but I was afraid of returning back to active alcoholism, so I forced myself to stick my hand out and say, hey, I'm Chuck, or hey, I'm Chuck. You know, I wasn't a happy camper when I got here.
No, you weren't. And it's kind of
funny.
Do
you remember him when he came in, too?
Oh, yeah. He talked about the 318 Madison group. A buddy of mine used to call it the apathy group.
Why?
It was just a little different. Before things kind of started following suggestions and stuff like that. But I think it's like anything else, anything new. And there's a bunch of people that were new to sobriety, didn't have a flipping clue between us about anything. Yeah. It took somebody with a little bit of time to spend some time with some of us, and then things got going. Yeah. And I kid the young guys, they go, oh, you'll never make it, and laugh at him. They look at me like, and some say, oh, hell, he was coming before, he's younger than you.
Oh.
And so, but every now and then it's kind of fun to just kind of tweak him a little bit, because that's what I was told. I would not make it to my face by my sponsor.
Yeah, I was told that too.
So, but, Spike can go a long way sometimes.
Yes, yeah, Spike can work.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm going to stay sober in spite of what you prove to you that I can do it.
And you guys still go to meetings, don't you? So even with several 24 hours, you think you still need to go.
I tend to forget things if I don't.
Yeah.
I might forget that, drink for me is not good.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about it is, you through the years you form relationships and you see the person that comes in with the deer in the headlights look, and all of a sudden the eyes are clear and they start to grab a hold of the program, and it's just great to see somebody find an answer.
Their families get back together that were torn apart, things like that. That is,
it's
amazing.
Do you think race or gender play a role in coming in and getting clean and sober?
I think it's only between their ears.
Yeah.
Like I said, I was scared when I came here. I was more scared of not staying sober than not being liked. There were people who didn't like me being there, and that was their problem. I didn't care. I had to get sober.
So, Chuck, anybody can do it if they have the willingness.
That's it. That's the bottom line. Hmm.
Yeah, I think it's there for everybody. You're up against your break, I think, or your cutoff, which is a good thing. It's a good thing. But it's for anybody out there, it doesn't matter how tall, how small, what color. I've been to meetings all over the world with people of different ethnicities, background stuff, and it all works. Like has been said in many meeting room, it's the language of the heart. I heard how they felt, and that still rings true for me today as it did in 1978, which was, this is a long time between drinks, and I'll shut up. You're right against your time.
This has been a wonderful hour. Thank you guys for joining in the discussion. Radio Rehab, thank you. If you have any questions for Joe or Chuck, you can email radiorehab@yahoo.com, and I will get them the questions, and you will get answers for sure, and you can find them in the rooms all around this tri-state. So come back. Hope you got some hope today. Family members or folks that are listening, you know where to go. You heard it straight from these guys' mouths. So do it. You deserve it. Your family deserves it. Thanks for tuning in. And don't forget, between now and next week, to do the next right thing.